This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of Reynaldo Ladaga, professor of Romance Languages at the University of Pennsylvania, reading from his libretto, Summer Maneuvers. It took place on November 20th, 2009, in conjunction with Ukbar Foundation's exhibition, Zeno Reminder.
Hello, friends and non-friends. The production is going to be, I think it's going to first be in Amsterdam and a couple of other places in Holland and Belgium, I think, October 2010, and Argentina in November 2010. And we are working on other possibilities, but so far that's what it is. And again, the text that I'm going to read is the libretto of this music theater piece. That the music. What?
You're just so high.
Okay, the provisional title of this, it's gonna be a short reading, about 20 minutes probably. And one day this is going to be sung, and it's going to be combined with the images of Fabian Marcaccio, with a long animation of Fabian Marcaccio, who is supposed to be here but didn't come. So the provisional, the title is Summer Maneuvers, and I'm going to read it. It has four parts, so the pauses that I'm going to make correspond roughly to the four parts. And the text was written originally in Spanish and translated by Craig Eplin and corrected by Margaret Sandel here. And then corrected again by myself, like five minutes before coming. So here we go. Our first task was to extract our substances from the slabs of wood we had stored away. But the humidity was destroying them. It was then that a woman took her son to the river to bathe him. She didn't take her usual path, and she came upon the wood warehouse. Her first instinct was to get closer, but shiny fences surrounded the building. She perceived that finding a way over them would occupy the better part of the day, and she too, like us, was suffering from hunger. That was why she sent the boy. She tied a note to his ankle with his name and birthplace on it. By the time he arrived, that note had been lost. We never found out who he was. She gave him a little flask with all the best remedies, just in case he got injured. The boy tied it to the belt that encircled his waist. The sun had reached its highest heights. Soon it would begin to fall. As she was about to hoist the boy over the fence, the woman remembered she had seen, on her way to the place, a fallen body with a piece of wood in its mouth. She wondered if it was fitting to order her boy to carry a piece of wood by his teeth, to show he was originally from there, to show where he belonged. But then he might need to use his teeth on the path leading from the fence to the warehouse. She decided then to improvise a necklace made from the bits of wood she had with her. Shortly before nightfall, the boy departed. He came in our direction. He crossed the rock terrain that lay between the fences and the construction where we had gathered. If just once we had moved from where we were, we would have learned of the opportunities and dangers presented by the terrain. But as we prefer not to, we never discovered upon seeing him what had produced the scrapes on his arms, not if it was some sort of fright that had left him mute like he was. When the boy arrived at where we were, when we saw him appear at the gate, we were ready in ourselves to leave. We had turned out the lamps, we had covered the remaining pile of wood with sheets and blankets, we had washed the bowls and glasses. We didn't expect to find a soul alive in the whole region, so we looked to our leader, who was putting away the ornaments that we would take with us on our travels, the flags and metal constructions that represented us. We didn't want to bother him and stay there, silent and rapt. The child has ignored us and walked in the direction of our leader, walked on the cement floor in his direction, reached him, extended now an arm and was about to touch him. Our leader turned around and in a sudden movement grabbed him by the wrist, lifted him up and stood there looking at him as one looks at a recently captured creature. The child's eyes were closed. Bits of wood hung from his neck. A flask hung from his belt. We quickly formed a circle around them and began to discuss what we would do. We allowed words to circulate. By the time the last of these had ceased, we had made up our minds. We took the child with us. We carried our little boat along with our weapons and our provisions. We left the shore, we cut the rope into pieces, we doused the wharf in gasoline, lit it on fire, burned it as if we planned never to return. Soon after, we were crossing the stretch where the sea becomes denser and comes to a stop between two chains of little islands, two ancient volcanic formations, two very irregular compositions of lands and rocks and very low vegetation. The water is calm in this area. The blue of the water is crossed by greener and slower currents. One of these islands was the homeland of our leader, also the repository of the most ancient tattoos. On his dark skin, the tattoos in the lamplight were quite visible, because he had decided to spend the night naked, with a scarf tied to his head and plastic bags around his feet. Thus, if someone had flown over the sea that night, he would have seen some 20 men in a little boat. These men would carry rifles and machetes. These men would have covered themselves with a plastic sheet to avoid being splashed by the water. At the helm would be a naked man who would hold a child in his arms. Where would these men be going? To the islands where tourist resorts abound, where the sea is resplendent, where the animals are tame and the ghosts withdrawn, where there's vast numbers of men, women, and children willing to exchange pleasure for money, where men and women wear new shirts with flowery prints and walk in the bars, among the tables, and stand in the shacks next to the sea and lean on the counters and look with feigned enthusiasm at the tourists. We landed on the south side of the island. Before moving on, we looked toward the sky. To our surprise, neither the birds nor the stars higher up coalesced as flocks or constellations. We understood that we'd have to trust our natural sense of direction. We couldn't wait until the days were clearer or the signals more evident. Starting out, we remember that the air in the south is very hot and overwhelms and makes us ill. The people who live in this land are impetuous. Their mouths and tongues are full of poison. The inhabitants are passionate and volatile. When they're speaking with someone, if a drop of saliva falls on their interlocutor, his arteries swell up and burst. When people there curse at a tree, it dries up. When they spit on an animal, it dies. After crossing the meager swamps, we enter the city through its working-class neighborhoods, where they make the little wax figures, the tapestries, the glass boxes, and other emblems used in their masses. When we pass through the door of steel, all the hands of the men who saw us close around the sticks that they carried. The walls of the house were encrusted with brilliant stones, the doors painted white. When we pass by, the shades didn't open. Perhaps they never open. There are places there where surgeries are performed. There are places where lamb's meat is sold. There are stores selling liquors and wines. Everything is labor and industry. Everything moves inexorably. The looms make a noise that evokes, for those who listen, a life that leads to seclusion, to an ordered existence devoted to useful occupations, the existence of persons living on their work and not on intrigue, slander, and deception. But this impression is false. In truth, the people there lack courtesy. Their character is harsh. They are proud, oversensitive, vengeful. In that neighborhood, as soon as night falls, all you hear are insults, cursing, and threats. Couples there never agree on anything. When a wife wants to attend morning prayers, her husband wants her to meet in the public baths. When she's fasting for a day, he's preparing a pardon and demanding that she attends. When she must give charity to the poor, he demands she works on family problems. When she wants to receive travelers to their home, he closes all the gates. We didn't linger on the momentary distractions that the town offered. We replenished our provisions and took to the road again. The final kilometers were an expanse of rocks, so we walked barefoot. The feet hurt. There were moments in which we felt like piles of bones upon which other piles of bones were piled, and piles of leaves over which other piles of leaves were piled. Bones that took too long to turn to dust, leaves that too slowly turned to mold. Our leader and his child must have felt it in a deep way, because their steps slowed and they whispered to each other words that we couldn't hear. There were moments when we thought we'd have to leave them there, sitting on some rock, watching the seas retreat. But immediately, at a distance, we saw the hotel. We recall the descriptions we had read in pamphlets and in reports by other visitors. We knew that in the hotel the guests can make multiple decisions. Those who wish to return to simpler forms of existence can hide in the dwellings, in the rooms in the dwellings, in the clearings of the small trees coverings that surround the complex, in the most remote areas of the extensive shore. Those who wish, on the other hand, to be part of the variable communities constituted there can join other guests in the three freshwater pools or at the tables of certain restaurants where there are waiters whose gestures initially seem affected but whose grace later wins them over. The dwellings are spread among the gardens. Each of them has a glass pavilion for massages, tandem showers and chairs draped with the textiles of the islands, water beds that simulate flotation, lamps of iron and tables of dark wood, airy curtains that undulate, walls the colors of sage or of mice, bathrooms with floors made of stones and hand-painted mosaics, numerous bathrobes and mirrors, flat-screen televisions, telescopes for observing whales. The restaurant's main room is enclosed in glass doors. The menu changes daily, in accordance with the season and the daily catch. Hake is wrapped in ham and served with cantaloupe and a lime vinaigrette. Tuna comes with an onion marmalade and an habanero merlot sauce. The chocolate cake is accompanied by a light pepper cream and an egg-based ice cream that's entirely superfluous. The main pool is on a terrace with a wood floor. The dozens of beach chairs arrayed around it are flanked by beach umbrellas. In a second pool farther off, guests swim naked, just as others do in a section of the beach, while observing those who snorkel, those who sail boats, those who cover themselves in wet sand, those who jump off the neighboring hills in narrow parachutes. In the spa, the treatments began with a ritual conceived to wash away previous tensions and anguishes and to prepare us for a deeper relaxation. A masseur bathes our feet with jasmine water and brushes them with sprigs of mint. Then he works on our bodies with a mix of scented cloves, ginger, and cinnamon. Or he dunks us in a tiny pool and gives us massages underneath the water. Or he balances our energies with Ayurveda methods. or he applies magnets to our spines. For our faces, there are treatments that use silk compresses or galvanic frequencies or the skins of little animals or antioxidant vitamin serums. So the toxins that are eliminated won't return. We are invited to drink cold shapes of nopal and mango. When we finish the sessions, we are invited to take a walk through the labyrinth that's been constructed on a platform over the herb garden. We came in through the main gate where no one was watching. There was no one on the path that ascended to the hotel. Our leader left the child on the floor, the child wearing a necklace made of bits of wood and a flask tied to his belt, so he could reveal the child the path to us. When we saw him move, it made us think of those crabs that inhabit the seabed far from the sun's reach, creatures that have only simple light receptor systems and who live hoping for some rapid current to pass close them by them. Our leader ordered us to follow him. He ordered us also to sing our rules of conduct. One mustn't torment others, we heard ourselves saying. And we continued, one mustn't be disagreeable. One mustn't give excessive thanks. One mustn't be unstable and fluctuate too much in one's own desires or repulsions. One mustn't set traps to get revenge on others. One mustn't hurry too much or take illicit advantage of others when running a race. One mustn't maintain inappropriate loyalties. One mustn't behave like a foreigner or expect anything from others. If one fails, one must meditate on this failure so as not to incur in it again. One mustn't speak of the defects of others, of the way they move or speak. One mustn't turn the gods into demons. One mustn't seek the downfall of others as a means of our own happiness. One must recognize what is primary, forget about expecting compensation, discard poisonous foods, not torment our enemies through malicious slander that pierces their hearts. One must transform adverse factors into positives. One must destroy rationalizations. Upon reaching the most remote mental regions, one must reveal the secret to others. The chants, the laughter, and the shrieks, the new howls of the child made us overlook an evidence. There was no one in the hotel. There were no guests or servants. In the hotel, there was no one. There was no one except a meager trio that we saw there on a restaurant balcony facing the sea. They were three. The woman was very white. Her head was small. Her hair was a dark brown and seemed to move continuously, undulating and rocking like a nest in the fronds of a slender tree. We realized that she was the sort of woman who, when she dries her hair after bathing, she dedicates the same care to it as she would do to drying her pets. The sort of woman who rubs her stomach with vigor to make it more polished. The sort of woman who, after drying her legs, breathes emphatically as if she were running. This woman's eyes were gray, not the gray that darkens in moments of excitement, but the gray that barely changes. The woman was the first to notice us, already at the top of the stairs, already about to descend. Her pose was one of having just discovered, in a botanical garden, a rare flower hidden behind unexpected weeds. Immediately after, the two men turned around. One was doubtless a businessman, the sort of man who has always accepted the consequences of his acts, the sort of man who is punctual, a man who knows that he's not a perfect human being, but who possesses enormous reserves of energy, the sort of man who, due to his importance, moves in circles of people older than him, the sort of man who, even if he suffered burns on his face and couldn't light in the sun, would remain calmly in the shade. The other one, because he had such fine features and held a folder in his hands, must be the cook. The atmosphere spoke of comfort, but also of disquiet. It was as if the things hadn't managed to maintain the ties that bound them to the world as to a new spouse. The tables were where the tables always are. The floors were of the stone which we builders of hotels make floors, but everything had become accidental. For a moment, we felt uncertain about whether we were there and whether we were us. We didn't know that the child could walk, but now, stumbling alone, he was walking. We didn't know that upon seeing our victims, we would overcome the respect that they inspired in us. We didn't know that we were capable of descending the stairs so quickly, nor that the proportion of the restaurant were so meager. Our way of walking made me think of my adoptive mother's house, when on a certain night she had come to the corner where I slept, with her breast swaying under her loose-fitting tunic, and had given me a machete made of cardboard and wood. We didn't know that upon arriving at the balcony where the trio was, we would set the men apart and concentrate solely on the woman. In recent times, we had taken to practicing a technique comprised of 10 movements. They were 10 slow thrusts of the penis in the vagina. On the first thrust, hearing and sensation became sharper and clearer. On the second thrust, moans were articulated with precision and ceased being disorganized. With the third thrust, skin acquired a new sheen. With the fourth, the spine became firmer. With the fifth, muscles became tense. With the sixth thrust, one could feel how the urinary tracts opened for the fluids to pass through them. With the seventh, the penis reached its point of maximum turgidity. With the eighth, the impulse grew even more overpowering. With the ninth thrust, ejaculation drew near. With the tenth, a brilliance erased the world's perceptions. Our leader stood apart. The child raised the flask with the remedies. And then we felt a gust of mist and bitter air. That's it.
Can we ask?
Sure. Go ahead.
First, that was absolutely fantastic. And what I love, one of the things I loved about it was the relationship between very specific things and the lack of context and mm-hmm. the economy between the two of them. How will it work in the final production to keep that tension, if you're interested in that tension? Uh-huh. Together. I don't know what other elements come in.
I have the impression that the production is going to be a very simple production. Actually, it's going to be produced by a group of five, a group of vocal quintet, voice quintet, Dutch voice quintet, and the text is going to be also visible as text, right? And probably going to be the whole text running, but not necessarily the whole text being sung. But it's going to be more of a version of we are calling it opera, just to give it a name, right? It's the three components are going to be an animation that's going to run all through the piece, and a quintet of voices and a quartet of percussion.
And so there are no characters walking.
There are no characters. No. There are no characters. Exactly. So the music is in the process of being composed. So I don't really have more details. I'm concerned about the intelligibility of the text, which is quite dense in some moments, but. Mm. But again, it's going to appear as text, mm-hmm. too.
And do you know music? I mean, I'm wondering, I don't quite know what a libretto is, like, of course, actually, you know, and you hear this word, but do you work with a composer as you write?
I know the composer very well. We have worked already in an opera that we produced about 15 years ago. We are close friends since we are 18. Or so I know his music very well. I don't know the specific music that he's composing for this opera, but I know his music. His music tends to focus on the tends to work a lot with drones and to focus a lot on the texture of sounds, right? So it's unlikely that this that the text, and I'm sure that the text is not going to be sung in anything resembling lyrical singing. So we have worked together a little bit in the libretto, and he's suggested changes. He also rejected two previous librettos. So, but the way that this is happening is that the text existed as such. I mean, I wrote the text without having an idea of who are going to be the musicians and the singers, but not the details of the music.
But what were you thinking? Like, what is a libretto?
A libretto is a text that that someone one day will sing, or even if the singing is very close to speaking, let's say. It's a text of the piece. It's simply the text of the piece. It's simply the text. I mean, if it could also include stage indications, right? But it's not the case here. And in part because again, it's going to be very close to a concert version.
And the images are going to be abstract, or do you have an idea?
The images are not entirely abstract, no. The images are made a little bit, I would say, as the text is made, right? The text is made of a lot of little materials coming from many different places, and reworked and translated and retranslated and reworked, so that I really don't remember where most of them come from at this point, right? But the artist works with typically with material that he takes from the world at large, photographs mostly. But reworks it in different ways, and it's going to be an animation. It's,
like a screen.
Yeah, it'll be like a screen. It's going to be a screen behind the. We are trying to develop a system that is flexible enough, because this is going to be produced in places that are very different from each other. It's going to be produced on an Italian theater. On a room like this, in many different places, where we are working in developing a structure that would be adjustable to different venues, right? But it's probably in all cases it's going to include a screen and the animation, and the singers, and the musicians, and hopefully some public.
Anxiety the piece produces. Like,
yeah?
This evacuated political scene, somehow produces incredible. I don't know. I mean, people laughed and I laughed as well, but the laughter for me at least was always full of anxiety too, or latching onto moments when it felt like I could laugh, because it's a release of anxiety that had been building up. I don't know if that's part of. I don't know if that's something you thought about or wanted to say in some ways, but. It's kind of a free-floating, non-attached anxiety. I suppose
it is. To me, it's very difficult to calibrate the effect, right? Beyond the effect that it provokes in me while working, right? So yeah, it makes me anxious, and there's a, I mean, obviously I tend to keep the since again my way of working is by accumulating large amounts of stuff and then and then reducing and reducing and reducing. I realize that I tend to keep what is more enigmatic to me, including enigmatic in terms of where exactly it came from. but I suppose that I am, since I am a professor too, right, and a critic, I generally feel that I have to make an exercise of separation, right, in my propensity to try to understand and calibrate exactly what I'm doing, right? So.
You mean because you have to. You mean like the way a lecture goes?
No, not the way a lecture goes, but that since I professionally read texts like this, interpret texts like this for others, let's say, right? It's difficult to fight the inhibition that produces when you're writing a text, right?
I'm just interested in the fact that you said you're kind of calling it opera so as to have something to call it because it kind of combines a variety of elements in the way opera does, but because you are staging it as a theatrical production, I was just wondering if there are any other sort of traditions of theater or projects that kind of interest you in the way they combine these things, just because what you described to me kind of sounds like it has elements of what like ancient Greek classic theater was, with this sense of this collective body and with song that isn't necessarily in song format as we think of it.
I suppose that there's a kind of like, I think in both of me and the, I would say me and the composer more than the artist perhaps, a kind of like archaic side of our imagination or a side of our imagination that is propense to something that the word archaic seems to connote more or less well. So what you're saying is, I mean, I'm happy to I think that I have to say if to me the most successful recent the artist that to me has been working on this kind of musical theater that I feel has been more successful is Robert Ashley, and in Robert Ashley, and I think that I mean what Robert Ashley does is completely different at the level of text. I don't know if you know his work. He's a contemporary. He must be in his 70s or 80s American composer who's been working since the 50s, but beginning in the late 70s, started to work almost exclusively in opera. The first important piece that he made is a television opera, I mean an opera to be shown on TV called Perfect Lives. And since then, that's 79 I think, he's been working with the same quartet of singers and developing at forms of singing that have little to do with the lyric tradition and that are well suited to complex texts as Ashley's texts themselves are. So I think that to me is the model that I find more inspiring. But I'm sure that there's many.
To the speed of the reading, was it the part of the text in this case?
Sorry?
The speed, your speed of the reading.
Yeah.
Was it the part of the text in this case?
You mean that
was it supposed to be so fast, or was it just?
No. I suppose I was reading fast because I have a little fear of being up here. No. This must have been 15, 20 minutes. Librettos of this kind of pieces typically have to have to be quite short, because when they are put into music, they are stretched enormously, right? So this must have been, I don't know how long it took, 15, 20 minutes perhaps, but it's going to develop much slower in the piece is going to be somewhere in between probably an hour and 15 minutes and an hour and a half. So it's going to be much, much, much slower than this.
Thank you so much for a fantastic.
Thanks. Thanks for coming.